Good morning, everyone. Good to see you. John chapter 4, we're finishing up the second half of that chapter here this morning and getting into chapter 5. In fact, we pretty well have finished through the latter part of chapter 4, but just reviewing that for a moment here. Remember that Jesus has gone back to Galilee, went through Samaria on the way, and there was the teaching of the woman at the well, and all of the events that took place there. In fact, there were many that heard and believed Jesus after that event because the woman went back to town and told others what she had heard, and they came to see Jesus, and they came to listen, and many believed. Well, from there, Jesus traveled further north to Galilee. That was his goal. He was heading on his way to Galilee, went to Cana of Galilee. And as we said, as he went to Galilee, it was sort of like a going home to some degree. That's the area that he was raised in. And yet Nazareth was never a friendly place for him to go. A prophet was without any respect in his home, Jesus would say. It was there while Jesus was in Galilee that the nobleman from Capernaum came to him and said, "Would you come with me and heal my son?" Remember that? But instead of going, Jesus didn't actually go back with him, but talked with him some there. And basically, Jesus healed his son, who was still back in Capernaum, 25 miles away. It's kind of an interesting episode when you think about it. You know, I don't know that the nobleman really believed that Jesus was the Son of God. I think he surely understood Jesus could perform miracles. That was becoming pretty well known at this point. But as the text would say, that when the nobleman was convinced to go home, he got home and found that his son was healed, and that his son was healed at precisely the time he had talked with Jesus about it before. He believed, and the text says his household believed as well. And we're just reminded again of the purpose of such miracles as this. Miracles from God always for the purpose of confirming the word, confirming what Jesus had said or confirming what the apostles had said. In the Old Testament, the miracles proved and confirmed what the prophets said. There was always a purpose for the miracles, is all we're saying with that, just to be reminded of those things. And so Jesus demonstrated his power over distance, I guess you could say. You know, when he healed the son, you know, 25 miles away in Capernaum. Well, as we get into page 18, on the back side there, page 18 of your outline, lesson 9, we find here that Jesus traveled again to Jerusalem. Well, there's some question exactly what feast he's going to, because the text says that he's going there for a feast. And what would that feast be? Though it's a little bit hard to think that there would be a feast that would draw him to Jerusalem besides it being the Passover. In fact, we talked about this before in one of the earlier chapters, that there are four events or Passovers that Jesus can be accounted for during his ministry. We read in John chapter 2 and now John chapter 5. In John chapter 6, it takes place again. And you think, well, how could that be so soon? That's only a chapter away. But there's a year that transpires in that period of time from John chapter 5 to chapter 6. And it's, again, just one of those reminders that, you know, in John's gospel, some of the early part of the ministry, most of the early part of the ministry of Jesus, kind of goes by in pretty rapid succession. Matthew and some others go into a little more detail in the early part of the ministry of Jesus. But what John's trying to get to is, and spends half of this gospel writing about the last 10 days or so of his life, prior to the crucifixion and the events after that. So yeah, in a very quick way, we get to the third Passover in John chapter 6, and then the fourth Passover in John 12. Well, in the text here that we're looking at as we get into chapter 5, there is more proof that Jesus is the Son of God. And so we've seen as the story has kind of gone along that now in a very out front way, Jesus is doing things to demonstrate his divinity. And maybe in some gospels, the parallel gospels might record, it seems like it was a little while before Jesus became so much out front, so to speak. But as we're going through in a more rapid way here in John, at this point, yeah, he's out front with the fact. He's going to say that he's the Son of God. And of course, the Jewish leaders are not going to like that. And that's going to cause some problem. But the event that takes place here in John chapter 5, the healing of the lame man at the pool of Bethesda, that's an interesting story in itself. And I think there's some points that we can talk about. There's a couple of questions I've got that I'm just not exactly sure how to answer. A couple of ideas. And I'm anxious to hear your thoughts and comments on that. But as we get into John chapter 5 here, let's begin by reading the first few verses. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Verse 5. And a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there, he knew he had already been in that condition a long time and said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Well, let's stop there for a minute. Now I'm reading out the King James Version. Do some of you have a version that reads anything different than mine? Anybody missing some verses? Huh? Yeah. Well, that's kind of different. You know, that's different than mine. You know, New King James Version, as do some others, include all of verse 3 and verse 4. But now, if you're looking at King James Version, at least some of them, or a revised version or American Standard Version, it probably doesn't have but half of verse 3 as I've read it. And verse 4 is not there at all. Now, what's up with that? I mean, why the differences here? What's going on?
It has to do with the difference of manuscripts and what manuscript included, which was considered verified.
Okay. All right. So, in a little more detail on that. So, what happened? I mean, what's the difference in the manuscripts here? Anybody looked at that at all? I mean, and if you have a version that includes that, you would think nothing about it. You wouldn't know that it's not there in some. But in some translations, it's not there. And as has been said, some of the oldest manuscripts do not include the words of the last part of verse 3 or verse 4 as we record verses. So what do you make of that? And how do we deal with that? I mean, why is it in some? If it's not in some, why is it in others? How do we deal with that? That's something to think about a little bit, isn't it?
We didn't have good Xerox copiers. Back in those days, we had men copying it. And from time to time, something could, on one manuscript, might not be exactly the same. He skipped a line.
Or someone had something in.
Yeah.
All right.
In later manuscripts.
You know, one time here a while back when we were studying something, I forget, we talked some about the scribes and the work that the scribes did, the training that they had, how exact and precise they would have to be. I mean, the way they made their writing, their letters was always exactly the same from one to another. You know, they're just very precise in that way. Well, it would appear, you know, because when you go to the oldest manuscripts, the last part of verse 3 and verse 4 is not in there. Somewhere along the line, that got added in by a scribe, most likely. And Rick's point here seems to be what may have happened. Could you not sort of see a parenthesis here somewhere that a scribe in writing this over on the side in parentheses said, you know, for those waiting for the moving of the water, for an angel went down, verse 4, at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water, then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Parentheses. It's a description of what the text says. It doesn't change what the rest of the text says. He just explains it. And to me, in some ways, this seems to be the most reasonable explanation for how it happened. And so some of the translations that we read from come from some manuscripts that are not as old, or they're compared to the older ones, but this has been included in some of the later manuscripts.
And I think the wonderful thing is that we have so many manuscripts and so much evidence that we can have footnotes in our Bible that explain this sort of thing. It says, you know, we prepared everything, here's the case. So we can still have faith in God's Word with even a greater degree, I think, because we understand these discrepancies and why they might be there.
Why it would be such. It is an incredible thing to me that over time, as more and more manuscripts have been found, you know, how in so many ways they are the same. Somewhere along the line, I think there was probably a scribe that, as he was, you know, over on the side, in parentheses, so to speak, kind of explained, here's what this means. And somewhere along the line, another scribe kind of just included that in. That seems to be what has happened. But the point being, and I think this is the paramount point, if you take out the last part of verse 3 and all of verse 4, it doesn't change what the text is saying one bit. All verse 4 does is explain, you know, the event and what is meant is all it is. It's sort of a mini commentary there. So I'm not concerned about verse 4 being in there. I'm not concerned if it's not there. If someone's looking at the King James Version and it's not there, I don't have a problem because it still says the same thing. That is, people went to this pool, the pool of Bethesda, and they went there every day, it seems, because there was something that happened there, and that there was a stirring of the water that took place, and that when one went in the water after the stirring of the water, there was something that happened. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more here as we go on. But I did want us to talk some about verse 3 and 4 and why we may see some differences in our Bibles on that and have some explanation. Other thoughts or comments on that? All right. What about this pool of Bethesda? Anybody do any research on that? Well, what do we know about the pool of Bethesda?
Very close to the temple.
Indeed, it was. That's right. Just a little ways. In fact, if you were standing up on the Temple Mount, I think you would have been able to see it readily over some other buildings that might have been there. You could have still seen that. All right. What else do we know about this? Anything?
There were really steep steps that led down to these two holes.
Yeah. Right. So it was a pretty prominent place. It's kind of one of those things in town where I think everybody knew what it was and where it was at. You know, Jerusalem, we see pictures of Jerusalem today, and it's a very full, very crowded city. And I'm not saying it wasn't crowded in the inner part of Jerusalem then, but probably not like what it is today. And I get the impression, too, that this pool of Bethesda and the structure, more or less, that's around it, making up the pool, was something that probably kind of stood up a little bit where it could be seen. It was not as tall as the Temple Mount, but it probably could be seen. I want to look at a couple of things here that I don't want to spend a tremendous amount of time on this, but I want to get a picture in our mind of this pool of Bethesda. Most of us many times have read through the healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda and mentioning of the pool, and it's a little bit hard to kind of conceive what this was like. I mean, what do you mean a pool? What kind of pool would there be in town? Well, there would have been different reservoirs, in some cases reservoirs that were made for the purpose of collecting water for drinking or for bathing. There were some caves in town that received water that came in from rainwater where dams have been made and stuff like that. So there were various pools in town. There's a pool of Siloam. We're not there yet, but we're going to get there here in just a little time in our story. But, you know, just some things here for us to kind of work around a little bit. This diagram right here, it kind of gives us a picture or a diagram of maybe what old Jerusalem looked like, the layout of the city. In fact, I think we looked at the same diagram when we were studying Nehemiah. You remember in chapter 3 when the walls were being rebuilt around the city? how in chapter 3, it basically goes from one gate of the city to another, in Nehemiah's description of the work that was being done. And you remember which gate it started out with? It started out with the sheep gate, the one that's kind of right up on the top of the picture here. In Nehemiah chapter 3, Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, and it goes on different ones who are building. And next, verse 3, the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of, it goes on and on, the work that they did, you know. And it goes from one gate to another, you know, to another, just in this order right here. And in fact, that's one of the reasons, you know, we would know how to put on the diagram the names of the gates, because it goes all the way around in Nehemiah explaining these gates. And in digs that have been done, many of these gates have been identified, you know, even today. But you see, right here is the sheep gate. And we can see the temple, you know, approximately, probably over this way a little bit more. And the Pool of Bethesda is somewhere right up in here. And we'll get to that some more here in just a moment. But as you go through the third chapter of Nehemiah, it goes all the way around, starting at the sheep gate, the fish gate, old gate, all the way around to it comes back to the sheep gate. Well, what's the emphasis with the sheep gate? Why did they start there and end there? Well, what's the prominence with the sheep gate, what do you think?
A landmark.
Well, a landmark. But why is it a significant landmark to the Jews? What would have come in that gate?
Sheep.
The sheep. Yeah, the sacrifice. I mean, I don't think we're presuming too much here. But it is one of the closer gates, you know, to the temple, you know, where they would have brought probably the sheep that were being led in for the sacrifices. You know, so maybe that's why Nehemiah started there and worked all the way around. I don't know. Just something to think about a little bit. And it would probably have been the nearest gate to the Pool of Bethesda in this area in here. So it's just something for us to think about there with that a little bit. This right here is a diagram of first century Jerusalem. And I still kind of marvel at this. It's like, well, now, how would they know that this is where the wall would have been in the first century? And I think in some cases, they can determine pretty well because of some of the digs they found the old wall. Well, that kind of narrows that down, you know, in those cases. And because of descriptions given in the text sometimes. Now, if we're looking at old Jerusalem, like we've talked about the old city of David that more or less came down like that. By the first century, you know, of course, the city walls had expanded. And Herod had a lot to do with that in the early part of the first century, expanding the walls. But the Temple Mount, you know, is right here. And you can pull out some things that we've talked about recently in some of our studies, such as like Golgotha in the tomb, it's presumed to be right over here, not so far away from the temple. Right here is the Pool of Bethesda. And you know, they have found the Pool of Bethesda, at least it's believed to be the Pool of Bethesda. And so you can pretty well survey and figure out exactly how far it is from there to the old walls of the city. The sheep gate would be up here. It's kind of off of our picture a little bit, just up on that side. And then to add this in, this is modern Jerusalem, or Jerusalem today. Of course, the city is expanded, bigger. Not this side, but this side's a little bit bigger. But we've mentioned before, just to kind of get this in our minds a little bit, the city today is basically in four quarters. You have the Christian quarter and the Jewish quarter and the Muslim quarter and the Armenian quarter. And so right here, again, is the Temple Mount, you know, this area here. And the Pool of Bethesda would probably be one of these marks here. I'm not sure which one, right up in this area. So it's in the Muslim quarter today is where it would be. Just like the Temple Mount, remember, that's in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem. So we're just trying to get our bearings a little bit on this. And like, how do we know that that's where the Pool of Bethesda was at? I mean, what the text tells us, you know, is that it identifies it not too far from maybe the sheep gate. But how do we know that it's right there? And I think we can probably have a, a pretty good idea why we know it's there. You know, in the description that we read in John chapter 5, it was described as pools with five porches or colonnades. It depends which version you're looking at. And that's kind of a peculiar picture in my mind. How do you have a pool with five porches? What kind of shape is that going to be? That doesn't quite just seem right. And so that's always caused some people some questions. And in fact, for a long time, there were some who thought that the description of the Pool of Bethesda in John chapter 5, they thought, well, this gospel was written by some later scholar who had never been there. And some have said, in fact, the Pool of Bethesda was kind of a mythical place, just describing the power of Jesus and healing that took place there, but it wasn't really for real. That's what some said for a long time, for centuries. There were some who said that. But in the early 19th century, somebody found something. It was in one of those digs where they came to a point and they dug up some things that they said, this might actually be the Pool of Bethesda. Well, as time has gone on, that's become really just kind of more real, I think. You know, we looked at this picture, I think, just a few weeks ago. It's a model of Jerusalem. And just getting our bearings again, the old part of the city of David, and this would be like the first century. And the Sheep Gate would have been way down here at that far wall. And right in here is the Pool of Bethesda. In fact, in the model, that's the temple, it kind of looks like this right here. Well, how would you know this is what it looks like? Well, there's some reasons why. Some have thought this would have been sort of what this would look like. And it all has to do with the digs that have been done around the city and the things that they have found, you know, through time. And so five porches, five colonnades, I really struggled with that. And I still struggle a little bit to see it here. But I think I know what is being meant. There are two pools, actually, an upper pool and a lower pool. And so whichever pool you're at right here, you have one, two, three, four sides. But this comes through, I guess you'd call that like a fifth side to the pool. At least that's how some have interpreted that. And so this, you know, there's some, they haven't dug all of this up, no. There's buildings and houses built on top of this. Remember we've talked how, you know, Jerusalem has got like 25 layers or 25 dynasties to it. And so to find the Pool of Bethesda or anything else in Jerusalem, you basically have to dig down to another time. But they've done that. And we'll see that here in just a moment. Well, as you get near the Pool of Bethesda, you come into the courtyard, so to speak, of the Pool of Bethesda. What kind of stands out as most prominent is St. Anne's Church. And this is a church building that was built centuries ago in honor of the believed birth site of the grandmother of Jesus. We don't know if any of that's true or not. I'm just telling you that's why it was built and why it was built here. And so it was originally built in, you know, the 1100s, during the days of probably the Crusaders. And so the site here where this church building is at, and what's, like, if you're looking at that building right here, behind you over here is where we're going in just a moment. You know, this piece of ground here changed hands a number of times, as everything has in Israel. You know, through the years. It was in the hands of the Crusaders. It was in the hands of the Muslims. It was in the hands of the Crusaders again. Then the Muslims. Then the Ottomans. And then they finally gave this property to the French. And the French had something to do with modernizing this church building. And it was in bad repair and bringing it back into shape. And just a look inside, of course, there's a statue of Saint Anne, for whom the church building was built. But outside, when you turn around backwards from looking at that building, this is what you see. And so you have buildings here that were built in different periods of time. Now, they all just look old to me. But there are those that can determine by the way the stones are hewn and the way it's built. You know, they can determine when it was built and by whom. Like you're looking at a part of a structure right here that was built in the Byzantine time, which is probably the 3rd or 4th century, in that period of time. And it was, and after that came an area back here behind it Here's the Byzantine wall, and that's around that structure. Then there was this Crusader's chapel that was built maybe the 1100s, somewhere in that period of time, built up on top of what was already there. Remember, this has all had to been, you had to dig down to get to these things. And so that's kind of what's found there too. But now, if you kind of come back to this picture again, Byzantine structure here, the Crusader's chapel built over here, this keeps on going down. We suppose it's going down too. You know, and you start looking at this a little bit more. Is there anything here that would remind you of colonnade or porches? As you start looking at this. And it keeps on going on. It's just there's people's houses here on both sides. This whole pool has not been excavated because there's people that live here. You know, all around this. But this right here is believed to be the Pool of Bethesda. And here are the colonnades, and this is the middle wall that went between, you know, the two pools, the upper pool and the lower pool. And so just another picture to kind of get our bearings right. Here is the Byzantine structure that was built, as scholars have said, historians have said, it was built up and over the Pool of Bethesda. Why they built it up and over that, I don't know. It was to kind of mark the site, you know, as has often happened. You remember, in fact, I think I missed a point of something I wanted to say right here. You know, centuries ago, to mark a site of significance, churches were built over the site. And in some other studies, some of the things that we have looked at times, you know, like the Church of the Nativity was built in the early ages over the site. Some have believed was the birthplace of Jesus. So a site was marked to preserve the site. You know, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where some have believed was Golgotha and then the tomb of Jesus. And Jacob's Well, we talked about last week or so, or sometime recently, you know, a church is built over top of that, preserve that area. Well, it's just really no different with this. The Byzantine built a church building over top of the Pool of Bethesda. The Crusaders built on top of that. And once you've dug down through all of that again, you can start looking and you can see, sure enough, the steps that would lead down into the lower pool, the Pool of Bethesda. And from some of the digs, that would, like I said, this is just kind of the middle portion of the pool. It would have gone on that way, and it would have gone on back this other way as well, but this here is the part that has been dug and brought out. And just another view of, I wanted to go down in there so bad, there was a ladder, but I couldn't quite figure out how to get down to where that ladder was. And I was just too tired anyway. Don't tell Gary that. But, you know, I wanted to go down in there. Someone's been down in there, but I couldn't quite figure out how to get through it easily. But all of that, just bringing all of that up so we can get a picture in our mind of what is John talking about here? And what was this scene, you know, that he's describing? And where was it at? Well, we know it was in Jerusalem. It wasn't so far from the temple. And it was a place of prominence. And it was a place where people went to be healed. Well, that's another subject in itself. We can talk about some here in just a moment. But, okay, I've done all the talking here. Thoughts or questions, comments about what we've seen here? Rick?
Well, it impresses me over and over again how often the writers of the Bible put their necks out. Talking about these physical geographical locations, things that can be checked and can be verified.
Right.
And once, you know, and when they are verified, that should give us so much confidence that the things that cannot be verified
are there too.
Are took place as well.
Yeah. It's like I said, you know, there were scholars for centuries, really. There were some that said this was just a mythical place. And this was not really events that happened, but it's just a story to try to make people think about Jesus and his power. That's kind of the way they played it off, you know. But no, it's a for real place. You know, and we can see the evidence of that now. Well, we can have faith without seeing pictures and without seeing the evidence. I mean, what we know and what we believe is by faith. Like Rick says, it is interesting to me to now be able to see some of these places that the Bible talks about. Even towns or cities that over time people have said never existed, that all of a sudden now they have to say, well, I guess it did exist, you know, because here's the physical evidence for it. Well, hey, Gene, go ahead.
Maybe you're going to get to it, but so the physical place exists, but how about that parenthetical phrase? Was that real? Did people actually go there expecting a miraculous cure before Jesus?
I think this is an interesting question, and something I've struggled with some in my mind. I mean, was there healing that was taking place here outside of Jesus healing the man that was at the pool who couldn't get in? I mean, people were going here, and as the description takes place here, that there was a stirring of the water that took place, you know. And I mean, think again here of what the text says in verse 3. Inside these porches lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, and paralyzed. Stop there. And we go down to verse 5. And a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there, he said, "Do you want to be made well?" Well, the commentary added in by someone at some point says that an angel, they were waiting there for the moving of the water. For an angel went down and at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Was there really an angel that stirred up the water? You know, I mean, something must have been taking place. Was it an angel?
So it goes like this. You have the pool where they usually sacrifice the sheep. So if you're going to be just mean, they're either there to be sacrificed, the sick one, just be done with them, or just
well, I don't think that the sheep were sacrificed there. You know, I mean, I don't know if the sheep even went there. There was, in fact, in another reading that you can do, there was another place in a couple of those caves we mentioned earlier, you know, that it seems as though may have been a place where the sheep could have been washed. But this seems to be something different, separate from that.
The Bible says they went there to be healed.
That's right. And so, but how did that take place?
I don't think there's any doubt that people believed that story, that they were going there to be healed. I don't think...
Was there a healing that took place?
But the question is, was that a legitimate belief that that was going to happen? And I think that's why there is such a controversy about that person happened. So we don't know the answer.
It's interesting to kind of think some of this through, isn't it, Harry?
This perhaps why they had some.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's why they went there. They went there with the expectation of being healed. And the one who was healed was the first one put in the water who stirred the water after the water was stirred. Well, who stirred the water? Well, they believed it was an angel. Was there really an angel that went in and stirred the water?
Yes.
You know, it's, well, how do we prove that?
They found the wings.
Yeah. Well, that hasn't been dug up yet, you know, and so it's only in the commentary, so to speak, that we can kind of pull the angel part in there. I'm not as comfortable about that, but that's what they believed. I mean, we can understand this part, that they believed that it was an angel that stirred the water. You had to be the first one in the water after it was stirred to be healed. And so this man, when Jesus said, "Do you want to be healed?" He'd been lame for 38 years. Of course he wanted to be healed. Yes, I want to be healed, but I suppose he was looking at Jesus as one, "Are you going to put me in the water? Will you help me be the first one in the water?" Well, Jesus was going to offer him something more than that. You know, Rick?
A lot of times they say, "What we do know is that Jesus healed."
That's right.
That's what we do know.
But that here's what we can know with confidence, because it's what the book tells us.
Must have happened for real some healing.
I can see how the argument can be made with that. Because from the standpoint that it seems like something was happening for the people to have that much confidence in it. And yet at the same time, you used a phrase that I think is interesting, and I've used sometimes too, that, well, there's a difference between fake healings and faith healings. There's a difference there. And we can read of both in Scripture, you know, and we can certainly see a lot of fake healings today. You know? Of Jesus, right. Because Jesus is going to demonstrate his power over those spirits. You know, you're right. You know, there are some things about this episode here that I don't know exactly. I don't know how to explain exactly. What I do know is that Jesus came to this man and said, "You want to be healed?" And he said, "Yeah, I want to be healed." And he thought maybe Jesus would put him into the water. But can you imagine his thought and his expression when Jesus said, "Take up your bed and walk"? Well, I haven't got in the water yet. I mean, what was he thinking? You know, when can you imagine? You know, when Jesus said this to him. And two, what about this? Maybe we'll touch on it soon. Did this man have faith in Jesus? No. This is an interesting thing, because remember, it's, you know, we haven't read this far yet, but it's not till verse 13 that really that we can ascertain the point that he didn't know who healed him. I mean, he knew there was a man that healed him, but he didn't know it was Jesus, is what the text is saying.
He did afterwards.
You know, then he knew, as verse 14, I believe, is what pulls that out. But when he was first asked who healed him, well, I don't know. And so that's kind of an interesting kind of a thing here too, Darrell.
I might say that he at least had to have faith in the word of Jesus to rise and walk. Because he might have said to himself, "Well, I can't do that. I've been lame 38 years."
There was no explanation given by Jesus on here's why you need to get up. And so I think you could say that. You know, that he trusted in the word of Jesus when Jesus said, "Take your bed and walk." He did get to do that. But not really fully recognizing who Jesus was. You know. Yes?
So he's laid down. You don't know why he cannot move. You don't know the excruciating pains.
Uh-huh.
And so Jesus says, "Get up." And he's like, "Well, pains are gone."
Yes.
"I can do it."
Yes. That's a good point. Brings us to another point. Jesus, in the previous miracle, demonstrated the power over distance, I guess you could say. The nobleman's son was 25 miles away, and Jesus healed him. In this instance, Jesus demonstrates the power over time. This man had been lame for 38 years, and Jesus healed him. You know, for 38 years, you'd just almost give up if you're ever going to get any better, wouldn't you think? Felt different.
He had never had before.
He felt different and knew, in fact, he could get up. Something had changed here. And so, you know, it's interesting to think about how the man, responded. I mean, was he expecting to be healed? Was he expecting to be healed if he could get into that water right there? You know, but Jesus knew, I'd have to add, Jesus must have knew his heart. He'd be willing to listen to the instruction of Jesus, because that's the only way any of us can be healed, if you think in a spiritual sense, is to listen to the words of Jesus and obey the words of Jesus, because that becomes a very interesting parallel in this story too. You have the physical dilemma of infirmity, but you can parallel that with the physical, or the spiritual dilemma we have with sin and the healing that we need. And healing that comes in much the same way, by hearing the words of Jesus and obeying what he says to do. What if Jesus had said, get up, take your bed, and walk. And he said, I can't. Or I don't want to. And just chose not to do it. Would he have been healed? Well, no. There's nothing to indicate he would have been healed. I mean, much like in a spiritual sense, when the Lord tells us what we must be do to be made whole and pure and full in his sight, if we don't do it, we can't be healed. So that's kind of an interesting point that's made there with that too. Tony, one last point.
I think it shows how Jesus knew a man's heart.
Yes. I think that's an interesting point that can be pulled out of that too. Jesus is the one who knows the heart of man. Real quick, Kenny.
Throughout the Old Testament history, we have had incidents that where angels were involved.
That's true.
And so it's not surprising that an angel could be involved.
It's not that an angel could not have been involved in that. And that's an interesting point.
And this, the angels really set up things to happen and prove.
As a servant of God. I mean, you're right. It could have been. And this is a point for Wednesday night. Because I thought about this too. Perhaps there was an angel of God stirring the water. But to do that, you know, you had to get into that water still. You know, Jesus has power over angels. And that becomes the next point that can come out of that too. I don't know. I'm just trying to think some of that through. Our time is gone here. Listen, we've worked our way through most of page 18, but we still have some other points I'd like to cover on that. And then we will be going into chapter 5, verse 16.